The Crossover Podcast is going on tour. Next month, we are launching live shows in four NBA cities. October 2nd, we'll be at The Harp in Boston. October 3rd, at The Draft House in D.C. October 4th, at the 4040 Club inside the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And October 7th, at the Improv Theater in Philadelphia. Wizards GM Tommy Shepard is going to join us in D.C., and we will have a full guest list for each city announced very soon. Links to buy tickets for each show are available on my social media channels. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and online at the venue locations.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
If you have a problem with it, build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Dan Wojcicki is in LA Times, NBA national writer, father now.
Yes. I like this is how you treat me, Chris. You just bring me to your hotel rooms everywhere. I feel so dirty.
Last time we did this in Toronto, right? During the finals of the playoffs.
So cheap.
It is, man. Well, it's that or
when am I going to get to meet your family? This is horrible.
I don't have a family.
Okay, well, that's probably why.
Would you like to meet my father?
Yes, I'd like to meet your father.
He's a former Boston area police chief.
And, okay, that sounds right.
Yes, I'm pretty much central casting for Massachusetts.
Dick Mannix?
No, yeah, let's call him that. You might get struck in that way. How's fatherhood treating you there? Now,
it's really good. It's really fun so far. It's nice that he's sleeping well. It's nice that my wife is waking up with him when he's not. And it's nice that, everything's been kind of fun so far. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I'm sure it's going to get terrible soon.
Now, are you an incessant social media poster of your child?
I mean, incessant seems a lot.
There are phases of posting on social media.
I think like the way to do it, like this is what's great about like Instagram today. Like one thing that's good about it is like you have your post and you have like your story. Like my son is on my story a lot more than he is on my page.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does.
But because I don't do anything else interesting.
You'll eventually graduate to the, oh, he's growing so fast. And then you start to graduate towards those September pictures where they're holding up the sign first day of.
We did this before my first NFL game. My wife and I did this with me. It was like kind of a joke that I covered like 2 years ago. No, so.
I got to find a way to filter that stuff out, man. I need Instagram, if you're listening, give me that filter.
The problem is for someone like me is like he's the cutest part of me. Like, this is the best thing that, like, right? Like, he is more interesting than the stuff that I'm doing. He is, like, way more fun to look at than I am. Like, it's great. Like, he is, like, the, he's like when Jay-Z bought the Nets, essentially, right? He's a low-stakes investor in my game, but it's good to have his face out there.
Right.
And put him courtside and let everybody see, hey, look, there's Jay-Z. That's how my son is.
That's one way to look at it. All right. Congratulations. Good
stuff.
Thank
you very
much. All right, let's talk about a few of the bigger topics of this past week. I want to start with Markelle Fultz.
Yeah, that's a fun place to start.
Yeah. Markelle Fultz has played in just 33 games since being drafted number one overall in 2017. He averaged 7.7 points and made a total of 4 3-pointers during that span.
It's amazing that you're doing this off the top of your head.
It is. It's quite interesting.
It's incredible to see it in person.
It's amazing. All while Markelle Fultz has been battling some combination of confidence or injury issues. The Magic, they believe that is enough to guarantee Fultz and his $12.3 million salary for 2020 and 2021. What do you think of the Magic's decision here, Dan, to buy into Markelle Fultz for at least 2 more years?
I mean, I think for them it's a no-brainer in the sense that you have to kind of view that $12 million against what they could use that $12 million on in the market. And like the ceiling for a player like Markelle Fultz is so much higher than anybody that they could spend that money on. You know, at least with the way the roster is constructed now, this isn't the, you know, go get Tracy McGrady, go get Grant Hill era. It doesn't feel like it of the Orlando Magic, right? Mm-hmm. They feel like they're on a different tier sort of as in terms of destinations. That being said, if he's good, it's going to matter for this team because to me, they're in sort of that, could they be the fourth, maybe fifth best team in the East? Like, it seems like they're sort of in that range and they can be pretty frisky. I liked it. I think the second you trade for a guy like that, I think you try to give yourself as much time as you can on it. You don't want to be the team that invested a year in him, let him go because you didn't pick up his option, and then have him go succeed somewhere else. You know, if it's just $12 million on the end of your bench and a jacket and, you know, sneakers for 70 games a season, then so be it. It's a two-year. You're locked in for 2 years, and you've tried to get everything out of it. I don't know. What'd you think?
Yeah, look, I agree with you. I mean, the Magic, as Bobby Marks at ESPN pointed out, are over the cap in 2020 and 2021, so there's no real harm done outside of some money out of your pocket. They did make a reasonable investment in the trade of a protected first-round pick and Jonathan Simmons to go and get him out of Philadelphia, and it's not like they have great depth at their point guard position. I mean, Augustine's there, MCW is there, Michael Carter-Williams, but that's it. So, you know, if it's just money, you know, why not roll the dice? The question is, we don't have any indication that Markel Fultz is anything different. I mean,
he's a functional, still a functional rookie in he's like so many ways.
Agreed. But like, my point is like, you know, we are in the era of the off-season highlight videos on Instagram, right? Like
80,000 views. But I was one of 80,000 last night watching Markel Fultz rework jump shot.
Yeah, gyms. We haven't. Yes. Like we saw a lot of Ben Simmons stuff. We haven't seen a ton of Markel Fultz though all off-season. It hasn't been like a market flooded with here's him with his new trainer, here's him doing that. It's been relatively quiet when it comes to
maybe Markel he was Fultz. Waiting for that option to get picked up before he hired out the got the Antonio Brown people now maybe filming him and stuff. Like no, I mean I think. Look, there was like I did watch one of the workout videos, which was just a tremendous waste of time watching a guy go 1-on-0 in a crowded
gym. They call that the Yi Jian Lan workout.
Yeah. You know, did he make – he made shots on the video. He looked comfortable. It looked like the way he shot it in Washington. But he wasn't – I mean, this – he wasn't Jimmy Chitwood at Washington either, right? Like, he was a streaky shooter. Was probably more of a tough shot maker than a like actual good shooter. And he's behind, right? Like, you know, this should be, you know, going into off season three here for him as a professional. Like this would be a time when, you know, ideally he's becoming a 35-37% 3-point shooter where he's, you know, has figured out kind of what it takes to play point guard in the NBA. And done all that stuff. And he very well might have learned some of that from watching. But that's what I mean. Like, when he's, like, essentially, like, a functional rookie in this way, I mean, he's so inexperienced. He's been through a lot mentally. If he comes out of it, I think he'll be stronger for it. But, you know, that's a lot of time to miss basketball-wise. Like, it just doesn't – there aren't a lot of really positive stories about guys who lose 2 years of their career and come out of it and look great. I couldn't think of anybody.
No, I mean, look, but here's why I have some confidence that he can come out of this as a solid NBA player. First is he's no longer the number one pick. Like in Philly, he was always going to be the number one pick. So you go to Orlando and they don't give up too much to get him. It's top 20 protected. That
sure,
first
it's
pick
like a
move.
Pretty low risk.
So yeah, so he's not the pressure's not there. And it's Orlando. Yes, they're expected to be pretty good, but there's not this type of, you know, national media pressure. It's not a major market when it comes to the NBA. He's going to have the freedom to kind of breathe a little bit down there as a player. And most importantly, I think he's worked with the right coach. I mean, you and I, before we started, talked about coaches and being interesting stories. You know, Steve Clifford, ask Kemba Walker about the influence Steve Clifford had on him. Kemba Walker will be the first to tell you that Steve Clifford put him in good positions, showed him how to become a all-NBA, you know, type of player, and it paid off. I think Steve Clifford is the exact guy that Markel Fultz needs right now. There may be some tough love shown to Markel Fultz, but I think there's going to be enough of that to get him back on track.
And the profile there, too, is, like, really interesting. You know, he could be a guy. I mean, like, there's a version of Markel Fultz that's a tremendous defender. He's got crazy long arms.
Playmaker.
You know, yeah, you know, he could do a lot of stuff that you would want on sort of that kind of team. Like, he's not, in theory, like, he's not going to have to score 20 points a game like he did at Washington. They have post scorers. They have some, you know, some talent on the wing. Terrence Ross is certainly willing to shoot a whole lot when he gets the ball. You know, same Nicola, when he gets the ball in the post, like, he's looking to score. There is a need for kind of a slashing scoring guard on that team. I'll be curious to see how they handle him and like what it's going to look like. Is this going to be a, you know, he's the fourth guard and he's going to play second unit minutes and try to get his rhythm back 13 to 14 minutes a night? Or is it going to be like, you know, no, like he's a part of our future. he's going to play 30 minutes and we're going to take the lumps and hopefully we can make up for him. I think it's a really interesting decision that they're faced with. I think when you this gives you a little more time, you know, $12 million is a lot to pay for more time, but it gives you a little more time to try to figure out what exactly he is and how to best use him.
I think it'll be interesting in those preseason games and the regular season games. I mean, teams, like opposing guards, are going to treat him like he's Dwight Howard out there. Like, they're going to stand like 5 feet off him. We saw some of that when he was playing for Philadelphia. Like, does that get in his head at all? I mean,
I would think it would.
Like, if you're that wide open, like, does that kind of get into your skull that, like, man, and if you start to miss those wide open shots, is there a snowball effect there?
Well, and it's like you have to be on a team and where they're going to, I've seen versions of this happen with players, like, periodically. Like, one that strikes my mind is I remember that Matt Barnes had a preseason where he had some personal stuff going on. I don't know if you can believe that or not, but and I think he shot like 6% from three in the preseason. They played like 8 games. He took like 8 threes a game, and like nobody was guarding him. Like, he was wide open. And like the Clippers made a point. It's like, keep shooting. And it was, you know, we had a really productive season. And I think, there's no reason to believe that Orlando won't kind of have that message right away. It's just sort of what's their patience level. Again, in an Eastern Conference, like, if it starts costing them games, you know, there isn't a huge, in my mind, I was trying to run through this, and I'm getting ready to kind of do this stuff for my conference previews, and I know you're working on some of this stuff too. It's sort of like, what does the East look like 5 through 11, and how big of a difference is there between Team 5 and Team 11? Like, I don't know how big of a difference there is. Like, off the top of my head, like, it doesn't feel like there's a huge one. And if he starts costing you games and stuff like that, like, yeah, maybe the leash tightens up a little bit, and maybe those minutes go down, and you want to coddle him and you want to put him in a situation where he can have as much confidence as possible, and he can do that. But at a certain point, he might just be who he is.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point there about how much of a rope can you give him before he – you know, is Augustine, despite his limitations, just more solid and keep him out there?
I mean, because, he was great. He was great for them.
Yeah, but the way Philly treated Fultz, though, was weird. Like, they'd play him like 16 minutes in the first half and then like none in the second. Mm-hmm. So when the game actually started to matter, he wasn't out there on the floor. And that can affect your confidence, too. Like, if you're only getting like first half minutes and your team doesn't believe you can be useful, that's got to be a killer. I'm curious to see how much rope Steve Clifford gives him, and what kind of rope. Does he put him in end-of-game situations, even though Augustine might be a better fit there,
or Terrence Ross, or maybe he's playing with Augustine. Like, they're going to have to make some decisions, you know? I mean, what their closing lineup's going to look like. They've got a bunch of young players who probably want to be on the court late in games. I mean, first blush, like, I would think that closing lineup would certainly include Vucevic. It would certainly include Aaron Gordon. Probably Terrence Ross. Probably Evan Fournier.
Yeah.
And now there's one other spot.
USA basketball killer, Evan Fournier.
I know. That's right there. Yeah, French legend. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like they've got, you know, we haven't, that's no Al-Farouq Aminu, that's no DJ Augustine, that's no Jonathan Isaac, that's no Mo Bamba. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they've got a bunch of guys that are kind of jogging through these late game minutes. They're a really interesting team, I think. Air quotes around really interesting when it comes to sort of that second tier, third tier of the Eastern Conference. Mm-hmm. They are kind of, without like digging in a ton on them, a team that I sort of have earmarked for maybe an Indiana type run this year.
All right, let's talk a little bit about USA basketball, because that run for the U.S. team is over. They completed a 7th place finish at the FIBA World Cup. That's the worst finish at a major international competition. And it sparked questions about what kind of team the U.S. will field in 2020 and what, if any, changes Team USA should make moving forward. I talked to Jerry Colangelo this week for a story that's up on SI.com right now, and he said, among other things, that the preparation for 2020 is going to have to begin immediately, and that what happened in China will bother him until that Olympic cycle. So, Dan, what should USA basketball do about its roster in 2020?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that they don't have a ton of choice in this matter, right? That they're sort of at the whims of the game's top players, because that sort of, one of the things that I thought was interesting, and I wrote this in a column, where I kind of looked at sort of the factors that I thought were in play as to why Team USA, this was when they lost to France, like before seventh, you know, when it looked like maybe third would be an option or something like that. To me, I kind of joked in the comm that, like, okay, well, first of all, the first person they should blame is Kawhi Leonard, because load management has become something that everybody in the league is aware of. All these players are aware of it. They know they've got kind of limited mileage. And do the top players in the NBA want to give up some of those miles for what's viewed as a second-tier international competition? And that answer was obviously no. Nobody was looking to do that. You know, guys that had little tiny injuries valued their long-term health in the season more so than kind of trying to fight through it for Team USA, with the exception maybe of Marcus Smart, you know, a guy who decided to do that. But, you know, no disrespect to Marcus Smart. Like, he's probably not one of the 12 best American players, probably not one of the 24 best American players, probably not even one of the best 36 American players. You know, like,
and no, this is, no disrespect, Marcus this is, Smart, yeah. As I drop you further
as you
and
keep
further.
Going, like an elevator that is like the cords have been cut and as it's plummeting towards the lobby. No, but I think, you know, that was certainly one factor. To me, Chris, it's been, and this hasn't come up a ton, traditionally, right, like these World Cup, World Championship rosters are always worse, right? Like, it's you don't get the very best guys. You get kind of that next group. And when you look around the NBA, though, right now, that next group of, like, guys between the age of, like, 22 and 25, so many of those, like, really great players in the NBA aren't American. That's Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, Jamal Murray, you know, Karl Anthony Towns is ineligible because he played for the Dominican. There's a long list of these guys who aren't, you know, who aren't even options. And because teams have either missed or guys haven't developed names like Brandon Ingram, names like Lonzo Ball, like these kinds of second, third, fourth year players aren't the who's there, who's on that wave, you know? And I think, it's not really a 2020 problem, because 2020 is going to be just fine, assuming, you know, you get your James Harden, Steph Curry's, you know, Klay Thompson's, whoever, like you get the actual, like a taste of the cream of the crop, right? Like if you get those guys, Anthony Davis, you should be fine. You'll be so much more talented than everybody else, no matter, even though the world is very good, like Greg Popovich was said, this isn't about disrespecting them. I think, you know, to me, it's not, oh, how did these guys not win? I mean, they were more talented, but, you know, I do think, like, it certainly wasn't their fault that they're not the best that we could have sent. And I think there are all these factors as to why. One of them being that I think that there are just a lot of really good international players, and that a lot of, like, kind of the young American players haven't either caught up or aren't there yet. You know, that next wave, it's really Donovan Mitchell is, like, the one guy you would say, like, I look at this guy and I see a future Olympian. Jason Tatum, maybe. You know, maybe Jaylen Brown. After that, it's a lot of guys where it's really, really speculative. And if you go back and you look at that last Team USA team to lose in the Worlds, I think 2006, does that sound right?
Was that, yeah, 2006 or 2004 was
in the I think Worlds? It was 6.
Something like that.
But like,
they're like 88-1 going into
yeah, and like I posted on Twitter at some point in time kind of what that roster looked like, and that was, you know, 22-year-old LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Paul and Carmelo Anthony. It was the cornerstone for the next decade of Team USA basketball. And it was okay that they lost because they had established that this is going to be the cornerstone for the next decade. They figured out what the program's going to be. If you look at this roster and said, this is the cornerstone for the next decade of Team USA basketball, how many of those guys do you think will play in major international competitions?
I mean, Mitchell, I'm sure. You know, I think Kemba, though he's a little bit
older,
but, you know,
he's on the older
30.
He's on the older age of, like, I'll see you in 4 years at the World Championships.
I do think, you know, we goofed, you goofed about Marcus Smart and whoever, but in talking to Colangelo, I think Smart might find himself on that team. Like the a guy that defends like three positions, four positions. I think they saw a lot of value. You know, Jerry singled him out in our conversation.
Well, I mean, and he's a really good player, and he's super valuable to like kind of general teams. And like the U.S. Olympic teams have always kind of had one or two of these guys that you kind of look at and say, but I mean, if we're being honest with ourselves and we're saying, okay, do we want Marcus Smart on this team or do we want Damian Lillard? Like, that should be a pretty easy.
Correct.
That should be a pretty easy decision.
Correct. And look, this year in a way, it was it's inevitable that this is going to happen. Like, for all the reasons you articulated, like, the world,
teams don't win forever.
The world is good, and when you don't send your absolute A team, you're vulnerable, and that's what happened.
Well, but I mean, like, this wasn't even like, I mean, like, again, no disrespect, which
it was
means
a
like
B
here
minus
comes,
C plus.
Yeah,
type
this
team.
This wasn't the B team.
No, it was down there, and look, the idea, like, I don't think that they're back to where they kind of started. I think this tournament just sucked for a
bad
lot of reasons.
Timing.
Like, the timing going into training camp, you had a bunch of players that knew they were traveling overseas anyway, you know, yeah. China. And to be honest, like, the World Cup in the U.S., we just don't care. Like, it's big internationally, but nobody in the U.S. gives a damn. They care about the Olympics. Players, I'm talking players and fans alike.
Yes.
Like, how many people really care about the outcome of the World Cup? They just don't. Not to say it's not important, but that's just the attitude that you get.
Yeah, and I'd wrote that, like, losing here is bad, but, like, losing in the Olympics is, like, a total,
worse.
A total disaster.
That'll get the attention of everyone.
Yeah, and you know, but I'll say this, though. Here's something, like, you know, if that kind of load management, if that's something that is really in the foreground of a lot of players' minds, especially if we're talking about kind of guys that are in sort of that weird late prime or, you know, in their 30s and stuff that are looking into, like, say James Harden next season, right? Let's say the Rockets go to the conference finals. James Harden does what he normally does, has that kind of really super high usage season. So they're playing into late May, early June. He's got a month off before Olympics training. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, less. The Olympics are in late July.
Yep.
You know, they're early next year. I know this as someone who is, as I look to plan, you know, and talk to my wife about what next summer might look like from the finals through August, you know, there's not going to be a lot of time. You know, if you're on a team that plays deep into the finals, I don't know that you can realistically sign up for the Olympics.
Like, can I hit you on that, though? Like, I mean, do we overreact to playing a lot of basketball? Like, there is a shorter period of time, but it's about a month, and you take a 2-week vacation. Aren't you just re-energized anyway? And it's not like you're going to, like,
I appreciate that you come to me for these high level athleticism questions. I think I'm in the right place, the right person to ask about this stuff. I mean, no, I think that, like, in a league where guys seem dedicated to, and this is all pro sports right now, is to find ways to get 1% better, right? Not to mention 20% better, but where teams and people are looking at the margins and trying to figure out ways to manipulate things, to tilt the system just even slightly in your way mathematically or whatsoever. I think, yeah, obviously, like, this is a problem. Like, if you view things that way, like, this, there's a chance this could make you 1% worse. I think that, you know, guys have routines too, and guys have become, I think, a little beholden to those routines and sort of their off-season schedules, and this is a pretty big, you know, deviation from that by going that early. You know,
the flip side of it, though, is that they know when it's over, and when it's over, they'll have like a month and a half off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, I think they'd rather have the time.
I mean,
off.
I just wonder too, even how they're going to handle training camp. Like, it's going to have to be like right after the finals.
Yeah.
Like, it's just going to, I mean, right? Like,
probably
it's gonna,
very early July, you go into something.
And like, maybe even, I mean, it seems crazy to think that they would, Team USA would convene during the NBA Finals. But like, you think about where they started this year, they were about a month ahead, you know, where they start kind of their tour, and you're going around and you're playing overseas, you're getting adjusted to time zones and all this different stuff that it takes to quote unquote get ready for this. It's going to be like, the final horn's going to happen on the NBA Finals. The draft is going to happen like the next Thursday, and then it's going to be Team USA's like starting right away.
Wouldn't the NBA love it if like Colangelo holds training camp like
during
the
finals? like they will have a third practice on media day. It'll be you will see the Western Conference team, the Eastern Conference team, and then whoever's left.
Then here comes like Lillard, Curry, whoever's not playing in the finals.
Well, Marcus Smart, clearly.
Marcus Smart, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of Bostonians listening to this podcast. You're going to get some tweets, just so we're...
Oh, good. Boston's usually pretty chill on the internet.
Very not...
I'll have Dick Mannix go knock on their doors.
Make sure that happens. I've been wearing the new Odyssey collection, and I really love how it's super clean and minimal, but it also has this unique hexagonal shape. They have tons of sunglasses and offer interchangeable watch straps, so you never run out of options for a new look. Movement watches start at just $95, so you're guaranteed to find something you love that won't break your bank. These guys are truly a ground-up entrepreneur success story. They understand living on a tight budget because they lived it too. And that's why they want to make a quality product that is accessible to everyone. They've sold over 2 million watches across more than 160 countries, and their collections are always expanding for you. Here's how you get a great deal. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/Mannix. mvmt.com/Mannix. See why Movement keeps growing. Check out their expanding collection. Go to mvmt.com/Mannix. Join the movement. All right, so you write for the LA Times. The Lakers are just over a week away from opening training camp. And pick your storyline out there. LeBron's relationship with Anthony Davis. LeBron and Frank Vogel. Jason Kidd and Frank Vogel. Rondo as potentially your starting point guard. Dwight Howard as maybe your starting center. Dan, what Lakers-related storyline, as you sift through them, do you think is the most consequential going into this season?
I think it's one you didn't mention. It's LeBron versus mortality. And I think, you know, as someone who was in Oakland last year when LeBron, you know, strained his groin and hobbled off the court and kind of dealt with a soft tissue injury that he'd never really dealt with before, you know, in those moments, like, you look really old. Like, all of a sudden, you know, and it doesn't take long when you look at a player like him who you say, like, how has this guy beaten time? How has this guy figured this out for so long? And obviously, he's you know, a remarkable specimen of athleticism, but also of hard work and dedication. And he's done everything he can to maximize his body. But, you know, this is a cliche, but, like, time is undefeated. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's going to come for him eventually. And I think you look at last year and you say, like, this is a guy who has been able to carry virtually anything that he's been around in his entire NBA career outside of his rookie season to the postseason. He couldn't do that last year. And you know, is he capable, and this kind of dovetails into some of the other things. I think he is willing to cede some to Anthony Davis, but I think willing might not have anything to do with it. I think capable is a totally different question. He's played a very specific way for a lot of years in this league, and he's had a you know, as much success as maybe anybody outside of Michael Jordan doing it. Should he change, or will he even be able to? I don't know. If I was him, I would probably, part of you would be like, you might want to change, but everything you've done, if you keep going, you know, and if you always hit on 16 and you never lose, like, why would you start staying? And I think that'll be an interesting thing to watch with them. To me, that's sort of the biggest thing, is because for all of their deficiencies on their roster, and I think they have some, and this is all a product of kind of the Kawhi Leonard chase that they got tagged along in, and kind of saw their cap space and just kind of sit and saw other teams add the role players and stuff that they probably had higher on their board than the ones they ended up with. I still think LeBron James and Anthony Davis are a good enough pair to get them as far as, I mean, it might not matter who's around them. That's how good those two guys could be. It's just, if he's not right, if he's not, you know, quite the same guy as he was 3 years ago or 2 years ago, then it won't be good enough. That's I think what I'm watching most.
Yeah, I mean,
or this could be a total revenge season too, and he could be, he's never, sorry to interrupt you, the counter argument to this is that, right, he's never had this much time to get ready, and that he should be as refreshed as ever. And I think that's sort of a secondary thing that I'm watching.
It does seem like he's quite busy this summer. I saw some kind of Instagram post, or, you know, got with a t-shirt and I got 13 different things going on. You know, I mean, he's busy, you know, not that, you know, filming Space Jam is necessarily all that taxing, but, you know, he's been out there doing a bunch of different stuff. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're LeBron James, and it's not the same type of player, but look at what Tim Duncan did in San Antonio. When he was willing to kind of cede control of the team and make it no longer his team and give back to some stuff, you know, hit, you know, give it to Tony Parker, give it to Kawhi Leonard, it extended his career. And it made that team even more effective when you allowed Parker to become the alpha, when you allowed Kawhi to become the alpha. That team was at its best when Duncan kind of gave back some of that stuff. Is it too simplistic to think that if LeBron did something like that, they'd be more effective in LA?
I mean, I just think it's just hard to do that. You know, like, I think it takes a special kind of person in a special kind of situation for you to kind of graciously step yourself backwards. And again, I think, like, you know, I mean, I think this is some of the issue with Carmelo Anthony. I don't think it's about want to always. You know what I mean? I believe that Carmelo, and I think this ties into Dwight Howard too. I've heard what Dwight Howard has said about kind of trying to do things the right way. He better be motivated. Like, he might be out of the league this might be his last chance.
No, we can eliminate might be.
So he has all the reason in the world to be at his very best right now and stuff. And
it's hard to not. It's hard to buy the Dwight Howard. I've heard this at five different stops.
But I also think that at a certain point, like, when you've been like the guy, and LeBron is an all caps bolded 68 point Times New Roman, the guy since he was 15, mm-hmm. 14. I think becoming the 12 point courier new version of yourself is like harder. Like, that's like a difficult thing to do. And I think that applies to Carmelo Anthony. I think that applies to, I mean, Tim Duncan's managed to do it. Vince Carter has done it, but he's done it by going to places where he's not competing for titles. And, I mean, we're also 10 years past kind of Vince making this sort of transition. You know, it's not everybody who's able to do it. It's really tough. And I think LeBron has the basketball IQ and sort of the skill set to do it pretty gracefully. I mean, this is a guy to me who has always been way more magic than he's been Michael. And his ability to pass and do stuff like as a playmaker, and in theory, him and Anthony Davis should just be like a devastating pick and roll combination, the likes of which, like, I don't know that we've ever seen two guys in the modern NBA like that good.
Are we underestimating, like, should the Lakers be anxious about how this plays out this season with Anthony Davis? Like, I mean,
anxious is the wrong word. I mean, I think they should be thinking about it. I mean, he's a free agent.
Right.
You know, like, they've been down this road literally before with the guy who's farting over in the corner of your locker room. Like, this was the situation you had, you know, when you traded for Dwight Howard. Now, granted, the price tag wasn't as high, but it was still a pretty big price tag that you paid. And this was they have pushed almost every single possible asset they have into this pot for Anthony Davis for 1 year. Now, I mean, no, I don't think I haven't talked to anybody who thinks that this isn't a long-term commitment. Mm-hmm. You know, that he'll go into free agency next summer and he'll sign a max deal with the Lakers, and he will be the next kind of Lakers superstar, right?
But is this not, to your point, exactly what we kind of said about Dwight when he came and signed on with Kobe?
I mean, it does. This is you're in a town full of reboots. Chris, you know, whether it's Saved by the Bell on the NBC app.
Oh, I don't want to talk about that.
Governor Morris or whatever else. Right? I mean, this is a time where there are no original ideas. This is we have seen the script before for sure. So yes, they should be anxious. No. Worried. No. Cognizant. Yeah, they should be. Like, he's not under contract. And we've seen in this league how even being under contract doesn't matter that much. So yeah, they need to, this is a really important year for them.
There's a high degree of chance of success, of course, because of the talent of LeBron, because of the talent of Davis. I think Dwight, if he's in the right mindset, and I hate to even cast my lot with Dwight again because you do it too many times and drives you crazy, but he can be useful. You know, Anthony Davis does not want to be a center. That's why DeMarcus Cousins was there. It's now why Dwight Howard is there. Anthony Davis does not want to play the five spot on a regular basis. But man, are they going to get shoot? I mean, I've heard good things from people around the team about Caldwell Pope this summer. Like, mm-hmm. he has looked good to the people that have been part of those scrimmages. I like Jared Dudley as a role player with that team.
I think he's very good for their culture. I mean, like, Danny Green's a great signing.
Yeah.
Quinn Cook gives them some stretchability. Alex Caruso's a nice player. Like, really? He's a guy that I like. And
but
I think
is
he's
this not
matter
a team?
On this team.
Is this not a team, though, that it's more likely than not that they start off slow, because chemistry takes time, and how many new faces are in that locker room?
Like, well, I mean, it's sort of...
New coach, new structure, yeah, new everything.
I mean, I think, right, and this is going to be the challenge. Look, they benefit from the fact, just like the Clippers do, the schedule is very front-loaded in Los Angeles. They're going to be home a lot. They're going to have a lot of time. I think for them, like these trips and stuff like that, like they're going to China, I think that's a good thing for this kind of team to kind of just be around each other, get to know each other a little better. Obviously, you've got LeBron's mini camp. You've got all this other stuff that's happening. They're playing at the Lakers facility probably right now as we speak. The thing that I like better about this Lakers team than I did a year ago is that, like, at least they have like a mission statement now, right? Like last year they had almost two teams. You had all these guys on 1 year deals, and you had LeBron James, who's used to being competing for the NBA Finals, having these like incredibly high standards of excellence and stuff like that. And then you had five other guys that were like supposedly your future, your young core that you were still developing too. And you tried to mix those two, and it didn't make sense. Luke Walton was being pulled in too many different directions. Mm-hmm. And that way, like just by issue of how the roster was, they needed to pick a lane. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, so they have chosen a lane like very directly. Like this is not a 2 year project in terms of kind of this roster. This is a win. This is why they hung out and waited on Kawhi Leonard, right? Like instead of trying to maybe, and we'll see. I don't think we'll ever know exactly how seriously they consider the alternative. You know, if they looked at it and said, you know, a 25% chance of Kawhi Leonard isn't good enough for us. Like we're going to go out and we're going to spend on the JJ Reddicks of the world. We're going to spend on the Ed Davises. Like we're going to be a little more aggressive on what we think is a top tier of role player versus sort of like the guys that were left. The analogy I've used a couple times is sort of like, you know, when you see the footage of like a storm coming, like a nor'easter.
Yes. Does that help you? I know that well.
Yes. And they always show the grocery store, right? And it's like crazy picked over. It's like that's when the Lakers sort of hit free agency this year. It was like the storm is like everybody's already seen the storm, and like you walk in and it's just like a couple bottles of water here, and like you're scrounging around trying to find the right ingredients, the right food, and it's not as the shelves aren't as stocked as they were. And so I think they had to make a lot of compromises with their roster. They did okay. I think they did okay. I mean, there's veteran talent there. There's questions at point guard, which turns out is a pretty important position in this league. Is it ideal that their three best players are probably all power forwards? Like, that's probably not great. You know, that Kuzma's probably a four. LeBron is probably some version of a four. Anthony Davis is self-identifying as a four. Mm-hmm. Those are his pronouns. He's a four. He's a power forward. That's not a great start. I think that's an issue. They're going to have to figure out ways. Rosters where you can't get your five best players on the court at the same time are generally kind of doomed. Whether or not Kuzma can play the three or LeBron can play the three and guard threes, and how much is Anthony Davis willing to play the five. If all of a sudden your lineup is Dwight Howard, Kyle Kuzma, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis, that doesn't leave a lot of – like, there's not a lot of spacing in those four guys.
No, I mean, it brings you to Vogel, too. Like, that type of team is the type of team he had a lot of success coaching in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You know, they went super big with Roy, and, you know, Frank got more out of Roy than anybody at that stage. He turned Roy around to a degree, and then David
Frank
West.
Frank and the writers of Parks and Recreation, the two most important people to Roy Hibbert's career.
Exactly. David West was not a stretch guy, you know, and of course Paul George, who was a natural three. But, you know, I'm curious to see how much rope Frank Vogel gets as the coach there, and how much support he gets.
Is there someone waiting for that job? Is there someone in line?
There may be some speculation about that during the course of the season about his bench. What's your read on all that? Like the support that Frank Vogel has from that front office and upper management?
I mean, I think that the sense that I've gotten from talking to people around the league about it is that, you know, Jason Kidd has said, again, the right things about wanting to be an assistant and to do kind of work with people. But, I mean, a big part of a lot of the narrative early on for why Jason Kidd was going to come was to work with Lonzo Ball, who's in New Orleans now. Mm-hmm. It's a distraction. I think it can be a good thing in some ways. You know, I had mentioned kind of covering the NFL earlier. You know, I had the Chargers for a season, their first season in LA, and they had a first-time head coach in Anthony Lynn, and he hired Gus Bradley as a defensive coordinator, and he hired Ken Whisenhunt as an offense, or kept Ken Whisenhunt as an offensive coordinator. Two former head coaches, essentially both perfectly capable of replacing him at the drop of a hat. You know, guys that were, if you screw up at your job, like you, and it worked out great for him, and he had that support system, and he had kind of that level of IQ with him. But that was also a first-time head coach. That's not Frank. You know, like he's been around this, and it's really probably actually not even that much Jason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like Jason is regarded as like this great tactician. You know what I mean? He's this all-time great player. You know, who's kind of had a spotty run as a head coach, and so maybe, you know, for him, like there's a sense that this is a chance to rehabilitate some of that image and to, you know, to be a good soldier. But I mean, it's gonna come up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you mentioned if they start 10-12, I mean, yeah, like you're gonna hear it. I mean, there's gonna be probably photoshops of him wearing a t-shirt underneath his jersey and stuff.
Well, I mean, and optics matter in this situation, because what's the enduring image of the end of the David Blatt era? It's LeBron on the bench, you know, looking frustrated and talking to Ty Lue. And I think it was days later that David Blatt lost his job. There can't be those images of LeBron constantly around Jason Kidd. I know that their relationship runs deeper than just player coach. Mm-hmm. They're USA basketball teammates.
Yep.
There's certainly more that LeBron has in common, but there's got to be a bond forged, and that's on Frank Vogel to forge that bond between himself and LeBron. I would say this to it too. One thing about Jason is that I was talking to someone that is close to him early this week, and this person was telling me that Jason just says how much he likes Frank, and like he didn't know Frank at all when they, you know, sort of connected for that job. But he said he's had a great time, you know, being around Frank and working with him. So I mean, take that for what it's worth.
For sure,
but it's off to a good start.
In my mind, generally, like I just think that, like, you know, if you hired a chef, like you would let him pick the ingredients. It's just sort of like, you know, like kind of at least, you know, in terms of like your staff, right? Like you would let him, you wouldn't stick that person with someone and say, make it work. The last time the Lakers did this, famously, they connected Rob Plink and Magic Johnson, you know, and that obviously did not work. Will this be again, kind of another version of that? I don't know. It's a good staff. I will say this, like, I think that beyond Jason Kidd, like there's some really interesting names on that staff. Lionel Hollins, I think it'll be really fun to see Lionel Hollins as an assistant coach in this league, and to see if he...
That's another one that people don't talk enough about. Like Lionel, like another guy that wants to be a head coach again, like is not shy about, you know, telling people that. When he was doing media rounds, he'd talk about it. Him working for Frank, I mean, that's...
There are a lot of interesting names on that staff. And I think they have Phil Handy too, right?
He's on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So like there are guys that like LeBron has really good relationships with on this staff too. And it'll be interesting to see, does that kind of, is there an element of division that comes from that if they struggle? And, you know, I think they're more equipped to handle that stuff this year than they were last year, that they don't have to worry about sort of the delicacy of a 21-year-old brain as much, you know, I mean, like really essentially they have one young player in Kyle Kuzma, and like everybody else is, you know, pretty much a vet. Like that's like, this is a veteran team. You know, you would think they'd be able to handle some of the locker room politics and all that stuff that goes on over the course of a season. They'd be equipped to kind of that stuff, and it's a veteran staff too. But there is a little bit of an element that it does feel like it was sort of kind of thrown all together in a little bit.
It's going to be funny when the Clippers start the season at 22-5 and the Lakers are like 13-14 and everyone's talking about the Lakers. Like everyone's just covering the Lakers because of everything that goes on within that team. And so it's like, it is like a CW drama over there that with the potential for
CW.
You know, go a little
timely,
like overwhelming dramas, things like that. Dan, always appreciate it, man. Good stuff. Thanks,
Chris.
Once again, joining me in the hotel podcast circuit here.
I appreciate it.